gobernador del estado, Cuitláhuac García, surgido del gobernante partido Morena.
Te ofrezco una disculpa porque elementos de seguridad que debían protegerlos incumplieron la ley y sin ninguna causa justificada, sin que existiera ningún motivo, se los llevaron y los entregaron a presuntos miembros del crimen organizado. Una disculpa porque no se detuvo a tiempo la colusión de elementos de la policía del estado de Veracruz con el crimen organizado. Una disculpa por el sufrimiento que vivieron sus hijos porque no regresaron a su casa como querían. Les ofrezco una disculpa por la impunidad a la que ustedes como familias se enfrentaron, las dificultades que vivieron al denunciar los hechos y la falta de una respuesta estatal diligente frente a los hechos ocurridos en aquel enero del 2016. Y hoy hay que decirlo desde el gobierno que represento y frente a la opinión pública. Es una disculpa por las veces en que se intentó criminalizar a sus hijos y sin justificación alguna se les señaló falsamente. Que quede muy claro, Bernardo, José, Susana, José Alfredo y Mario Arturo eran inocentes y nunca debieron vivir los hechos que sufrieron.
En representación del gobierno federal estuvo el subsecretario de Derechos Humanos de la Secretaría de Gobernación. Alejandro Encinas prometió que la administración que representa buscará poner fin al estado de violencia, violación a los derechos humanos e impunidad que ha imperado en México en los últimos años.
En este lamentable caso, como en miles que lastiman al país, sabemos bien que la delincuencia organizada aún no opera en colusión con autoridades de todos los niveles. Sin embargo, esto no seguirá sucediendo. Este país ya cambió y el primer paso es que esta autoridad asuma sus responsabilidades para garantizar la seguridad y la vida de todas y de todos los mexicanos.
En Colombia aumentó el desempleo a casi 13%, el nivel más alto desde hace 8 años, a pesar de que el gobierno de Iván Duque prometió en su campaña política la generación de trabajos. Informa Álvaro Altamiranda desde Bogotá.
El presidente Iván Duque dijo en su campaña política hacia la presidencia de Colombia que generaría más empleos para los colombianos. La realidad parece ser otra, pues el Departamento Administrativo de Estadísticas señala que el desempleo alcanzó el 12.8% en el mes de enero del presente año, el más alto desde el 2011.
Para nosotros es claro de que este es un gobierno que basa su estrategia precisamente en la mentira. Y en eso pues le ayudan pues todos los que trabajan ese esquema, es un esquema ya mediático y que muestra claramente pues que los índices de desempleo hoy están por encima de lo que inclusive el DANE registra, que es una cifra que muestra un aumento, pero para nosotros está mucho más allá de eso.
Otro problema que agrava la generación del trabajo formal es la tercerización de los empleos, los cuales no dan garantías en remuneración económica ni en seguridad para los empleados.
Estamos diciendo que Colombia, oído, de la población económicamente activa, que son 23 millones de colombianos, estamos diciendo que el 70% del trabajo de esa población económicamente activa está tercerizada.
La tercerización cada día aumenta más. Podemos hablar, por ejemplo, del sector de los hidrocarburos, donde hoy pues hay más de 100.000 trabajadores que están tercerizados en la industria petrolera. E inclusive frente a los nuevos proyectos que se plantean allí, pues los trabajadores que están entrando y engrosando las nóminas, todos son tercerizados.
Ante estas falencias sale a flote el fenómeno de la informalidad. Este cada día aumenta en el país y peor aún, el gobierno nacional se dedica a perseguirlos por el mismo hecho de su informalidad.
Álvaro Altamiranda, Hispan TV, Bogotá.
Y así llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa y a Polina Basiliev. A nombre de Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
And next up on the stream of Free Radio at freakradio.org, it's the March 7th, 2019 edition of our favorite show, or at least I hope it's one of your favorite shows, Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. That's a long show with me doing a lot of introducing of interviews and topics all around civil rights on the street for the broader community, but particularly for our homeless folks and poor folks. But today's spoken version of this, rather than, let's say, the previously recorded version, although all of this is being previously recorded in a couple hours before the 6 o'clock airing time, because we don't have a studio still, and we don't even have a transmitter site. We're kind of a barren remnants of a radio station, but we're still struggling along. Today is particularly difficult for me because I'm sick still. I got a God knows what, some kind of virus or cold. It's been hanging on for a month now, and it saps my energy. So I'm going to do what I can and give you a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and a lot of recorded material without a lot of breaks for commentary, which I kind of regret because I think the commentary is important, and I'm also told, at least by the few who do listen to the show, that it's of interest to them. So bear with me. Anyway, let's jump in and swim.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Yes, and so on top of all these ongoing concerns that we bring to your attention periodically on the show, which is we're looking for a studio 10 by 10 with electricity access and internet access, bathroom access somewhere, and we're willing to pay $300 as a reward if you can find it for us for a year or any part of a year, you'll get part of the $300. We're also looking for the transmitter site, a place where we can put up an antenna. It doesn't have to be inside, outside, it can be on a tree, and it's a pretty low risk, although we are technically a pirate station, and you'd learn about the risks if you get in touch with us, which you can do by going through the website, freakradio.org, where you'll also find other things there, like some people's archives and how to apply if you want to be a member. Or you can contact me at 423-4833. I'm not any official rep of the station, but I'm a member of the collective, and I can pass stuff on if you want to join the collective, if you want to help the collective, contribute to it in any way, if you have questions, or if you have any criticisms of my show or commendations or stuff you want to hear on the air or talk about on the air that you don't think are being discussed that sort of are in my general area of homeless civil rights and sort of civil liberties for folks in Santa Cruz, very locally oriented, though a lot of the national ordinances, I should say laws, passed by the Congress or enacted by federal agencies and state agencies have an impact on us locally. So that's true, too. Number is 423-4833, and it's in area code 831. So a couple things are coming up tomorrow. In Salinas, between, well, starting at 3, I'm reading on Indy Bay that there is a protest about the killing, some say the murder, of Brenda Rodriguez Mendoza. Three officers apparently are involved in that murder, according to the folks throwing the protest, Brian McKinley, Carlo Culapad, it looks like, and Robert Miller. Those, I suspect, are Salinas law enforcement agents of one sort or another. It's all going to be held at Cluster, C-L-O-S-T-E-R, Cluster. Looks like Cluster Park, 401 Tout, T-O-W-T Street in Salinas, for all of you Salinas listeners, of whom perhaps there are one or two at least, or people who want to go to Salinas tomorrow, 3 o'clock, to protest police murders or shootings or inappropriate use of lethal force, whatever you want to say. Then that evening here in Santa Cruz, we have a memorial to Sherry Connable. Sherry Connable, some of you listeners may know regularly, was an activist on a number of fronts, peace activist, a homeless activist, an activist against police abuse. I knew her personally through her work with and to some extent against, in my view, some of the interests of homeless folks. But she was, she felt very strongly about it. She put much more energy into it than your average person and even than your average activist, I would say. She spoke eloquently. She was a good organizer. I've talked about her death a bit, about her death. I don't know anything about her death. She was found on the beach, and there was some concern as to whether she committed suicide or not. Different accounts, I don't know, can give you no further information on that. I spoke about my own personal involvement with her as a homeless activist, which mostly was decades ago, and mostly it was from a critical perspective. And I'm often told and sometimes feel weighted down by traditional concerns that when someone dies, you don't want to dredge up the bad stuff, you want to remember the good stuff. Well, I try to remember all of it, particularly since the purpose of the show is to deal with the bad stuff and to encourage people who are working on the good stuff to work harder, longer, and deeper on it. And if folks have been doing bad stuff, I bring that up too. But I've talked about Sherry a bit in the past. I'm actually going to try to find some old recordings I have of hers. I don't think I'll be able to. I was actually originally inspired by her speech in the spring of 1989, way back when for a year many of us have been organizing, going to jail, getting arrested, sleeping out, speaking at city council, getting people to come in significant numbers who are homeless to city council to demand an end to the sleeping ban. The law that's still on the books in Santa Cruz, Municipal Code 6.36010, now supposedly not enforced by Chief Mills, but of course enforcement is happening around other ordinances, such as being in a park after dark, being in a closed area, blocking the sidewalk. I continue to repeat this every show because I haven't heard that it's been discontinued, although Chief Mills has said it's discontinued, and I've recently sent for police records to find out just how much recently has been the case as far as ordinances, citations issued and stay-away orders issued by either the police department or the Parks and Rec Rangers, the most of whom are under Mills' jurisdiction these days. Or so I understand it, as of the reorganization of the police department a year ago. His memorial is going to be at the Peace United Church at 900 High Street, Friday night. That's tomorrow night, March 8th at 7 o'clock, for all of you who want to go. You can also go online, and you can see a story and a series of photos by Alex DeRosi celebrating Sherry's life. Available on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. And you'll see photos of her singing with the Raging Grannies, standing with her Peace Dove sign on Ocean Street, standing with many of us to demand that Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, be freed, opposing the Bearcat. That was the organization SCRAM, Santa Cruz Resistance Against Militarism, I think, something like that. That was the organization she banned Huff, that's from our group, from joining. I was never quite clear why, but she did. A lot of photos of her. On July 4th, there was usually a rally on Ocean Street where people would stand. They used to stand in the median until the city made it a crime to stand in the median. I still did, but I was chided by some of the more, shall we say, more nervous peace activists. This would somehow alienate the city authorities and the city police. Sherry did not chide me, as far as I remember. There's another photo of a circle supporting Linda LeMaster. That's Lighthouse Linda, longtime homeless activist, mom, often a homeless person herself, who was trying to take care of one of the Peace Camp 2010 activists, curb hugger Chris Doyen, who later became Commander X, for those of you who remember those days, who's since written two books, by the way, for all of you who are interested, some of which mention Santa Cruz. And there was Linda was found guilty of the now in question ordinance because of the Boise versus Martin decision, the 647E ordinance, unlawful occupancy. And it's a misdemeanor crime that Linda was found guilty of because she was sitting on the steps of the courthouse with a sign trying to take care of someone who was ill at 3 in the morning during that Peace Camp 2010 protest back in 2010. And then she went to court, spent a year struggling with court. A lot of people are in that picture. I'm probably around there somewhere, but I don't see myself. A lot of photos by Alex DeRosi, who's a great photographer and chronicler of the civil rights movement in Santa Cruz, that which we had of the civil rights movement. There's also pictures of her supporting the Santa Cruz 11, of which I was one, so she did support us, although I don't think she would necessarily have come to support me, but she would have. There were other people involved, and she understood the principles involved and came to support all of us at that time. So there's a lot of photos. I suggest if you want to remember her, this will give you some reflections, some memories. She was fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. I think it was a solidarity protest here with that. And it's quite a collection of photos. You have her conferring with a police officer, opposing drone warfare in a protest on Pacific Avenue. And I will reserve my critical comments at this particular point. I perhaps should know better, but I have limited time, energy, and space. Here's a protest against the war on Syria, which is, of course, the war in Yemen is now going on, and Somalia and Afghanistan and Iraq is still going on and is being supported by the Democratic Party, which I don't think Sherry was a big fan of. So she and I shared that antipathy, I believe, although she was a very practical politician in many ways. And I think that's one of the reasons that we had some friction. She was also the vigil for Sean Smith Arlt, the man the Santa Cruz police murdered, or shot, depending on how you want to view it. And we're still looking for those records for Arlt, to find out all the witnesses actually said. Those are the police records. They should be available now. And I think, I'm not sure if I put in a Public Records Act request. If I haven't, I certainly intend to, if that intention ever bears fruit. A Sherry Memorial coming up tomorrow, March 8th, 7 o'clock, Peace United at 900 High Street. Then on Saturday, from 1 to 4, it is International Women's Day, or if it isn't, it's the day that some Santa Cruzans are celebrating International Women's Day, and in a certain sense, perhaps every day is or should be International Women's Day until they and other groups of people who have been historically and currently discriminated against for something they have no control over whatsoever, to wit, their gender, until that's ended. Anyway, what it says on the indie media is, all the soup and bread you can eat for $7. So it's not for the poor, but I guess it's, you might be able to codge some soup and bread if you go. That's going to be at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which is on Ocean Street across from the Paradox Hotel. I think it's 610 or something like that. Or 612. If you get to that general location, you should find the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And that's, again, on Saturday, March 8th, March 9th, sorry, from 1 to 4 in the afternoon. I didn't make the Conscience in Action and the Huff meetings yesterday because I was a combination of both ill but also out of town. I had to go see doctors up north. And also I picked up some Street Spirits. So there is the February issue of Street Spirit, which I should have gotten weeks ago but didn't. And the March issue will now be available either, hopefully, in the library, the main downtown public library, where you can find back issues of the Street Spirit newspaper. Or you can get it from me if you ever find me on the streets again or in my car, which is a distinctive-looking vehicle with lots of bumper stickers all over it. There are a few of those around, but if you see one with a lot of bumper stickers, take a closer look and see if it's if it has the word fuck on it or has stuff critical of imperialism and the police, it's likely to be mine. I think that there may be some other folks with similar bumper stickers, but these cover the station wagon. It's a Volvo. And I'd be happy to give you some Street Spirits, particularly if you're outdoors or poor and likely to be soon outdoors. You can sell it. You can get $2 a piece for it. Keep all the money. You don't have to pass any of it back to us in any kind of Scientology pyramid scams of anything of that sort. You'll also be able to find issues of it at the Sub Rosa Cafe where we meet. Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, meets every Wednesday at 11. Actually, it's been getting closer to noon these days since we share the time with our sort of sister group, Conscience and Action, which is a group concerned with not just making speeches at City Council, which both of the groups do, and we should be at the next Tuesday City Council meeting likely doing that. That's going to be next Tuesday. I haven't seen the agenda yet, and I don't think it's out. Though I'll take another look before I end this section of the broadcast. Street Spirit is a newspaper that in the past has had articles by local Santa Cruzans like Steve Plaich, Linda LeMaster. I even used to write for it, and still, you can find a lot of my old articles. Street Spirit's also archived on the Huff website, as well as on its own website, The Street Spirit. If you want to go further back and actually read Santa Cruz homeless history, you should go to the HuffSantaCruz.org website and look for the Street Spirit and the Street Shit Sheet archives. Those are the two publications that cover a lot of the history of the Santa Cruz homeless struggle from my perspective. As well as, if you want more recent stuff, you can actually go to the Huff blog, which is on the Huff website, and you can actually read recent last 4 or 5 years, actually the last 10 years, of information from the perspective of Huff activists, mostly from my perspective, but from other people's perspective as well. It looks like the City Council agenda as of about 10 to 5 on Thursday has not been posted. Usually it doesn't get posted until later on Thursday or Friday. Then you can see what the mayor has in store for you, the mayor and the city manager. That's Mayor Martine Watkins and City Manager Martine Bernal, no relation, in spite of the same first name. And I've been critical of a lot of their shenanigans around excluding from the agenda, or I should say warping the agenda to their own priorities and ideology, in spite of the council majority of four wanting to put another slant on homeless issues and having to kind of force it through going to the city council meetings themselves and then trying to set the agenda for the next meeting instead of being able to do so cooperatively with the mayor and the city manager, which should be the way it's done. Although it has been suggested also by some activists, notably Micah Posner, that the agenda be set in a public meeting. I think that's a great idea. That is to say, the public should be invited to at least attend and witness, if not participate, in the formation of the City Council agenda. That could be done at a sort of a pre-meeting meeting once a week before every City Council meeting. And it would be a real a form of democratic process that would actually be democratic instead of simply pretending to be democratic and actually leaving the decisions to a select group of people, some of whom are elected by heavy political spending, and it's essentially an oligarchy, a wealth council, or a council that gets in because it has the backing of those who are well-to-do. I have a meeting with the mayor slated for tomorrow for free radio, but I'm probably going to have to cancel it. Although I'm able, as you can hear, to talk somewhat, I tend to go hoarse pretty quickly. And I really want to be in pretty good shape when I'm interviewing Martine, because I've got hard questions which I follow up on, and I want to be able to do so effectively, and B, without giving her a virus, which is what I've got. It looks like something like that. Although some would say, well, I'd give her a virus, for heaven's sakes. I would say, no, that's not playing the game. Not that we should be playing a lot of games here, but I don't want anyone to get sick, because this is a long thing I've had. It's been for at least a month, and it doesn't go away, and it's peculiar. I don't like it at all. And anyway, the issues that the Conscience in Action group has been getting into have been, the main three issues have been the Ross camp, making sure it doesn't close without there being really some meaningful alternatives, and also protecting the rights of the majority of people who are homeless who are not in the Ross camp, and make sure that they're free of police harassment when they try to shelter themselves at night, wherever they are in Santa Cruz, provided they're not, you know, violating somebody else's private property rights, which we know are incredibly sacred. Or disturbing some public health and safety concern that is legitimate, rather than, psychiatric concern to bigots who need really to learn to deal with different kinds of people in their general spaces, but don't want to do that, or who like to pin crimes on homeless people. Well, essentially tar a whole group for what is the behavior of a few folks, just as they wouldn't want to be tarred as housed people, because there are some thieves, even killers, even, you know, genocidal people who are in high political office who live inside houses. So it's really a housed problem. How are we going to solve that housed problem, for heaven's sakes? Okay, so another issue has been bathrooms and the closing of bathrooms all over the city, the fencing off of public spaces like the Loudon Nelson Center, the closing off of spaces all along the riverbanks, at City Hall, in front of the library, at the police station. This attempt to exclude and fence off the city in order to eliminate homeless people and make it more difficult for them to find any place to rest, which is, of course, now running up directly against the Boise v. Martin decision, I think, if we ever get attorneys who have enough interest in taking the case, or if the work by Anthony Prince and his statewide California homeless union, I should say Wes White, too, and some of us Huffsters, ever gets anywhere, because the right to rest, which some state authorities, some state legislators tried to put into a state code 6 years ago and didn't make it, I'm going to suggest we try to put into a city code after we eliminate a lot of this nonsense that has been kind of toxic bigotry that's been institutionalized into law over the last 30 years, ranging from don't sit next to a building, to don't sit on a bench for more than an hour, to don't cover up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night. There's a whole series of ordinances that need to be examined and probably discarded for their disproportionate impact on homeless folks in terms of their being selectively enforced by police for that purpose. That's part of Drew Glover's attempt, and actually the instructions to the staff to research those issues, something that's due back in 90 days. I spoke with him today to get some idea of what's coming up, and I was urging him to not back down from the kind of nonsense he's getting from the old Cynthia Matthews guard, who is framing his objections to the abusive treatment that the new council majority is getting from Martine Watkins. She's claiming it's a form of bullying and sexism on his part, which I think is a false flag, as they like to say in the business. As I say, bathrooms has been an issue, and that was sidelined by the ever, it's not fair to say ass-licking, is it? Still, it appears to me someone who is more concerned with the priorities of the city manager's agenda, which has to do with pleasing the well-to-do in the neighborhoods and attending to police department priorities, than with dealing with the issues of the broader citizenry, to say nothing of the homeless community. And so the Loudon Nelson bathrooms were closed at the it's hard to say it was at the initiative or simply, certainly with the cooperation and certainly over no objection from Izeth Ray, who runs the Loudon Nelson Center, under Carol Skurich, when she was temporary head of Parks and Rec. It's now run by Tony Elliott, but Skurich may still be the woman to talk to in terms of getting anything changed. Though Elliot assures me we can chat about it, and we'll chat and chat. We've been chatting for months about it. Chitter-chatter doesn't seem to have lots of impact on Tony, though he's a personable fellow, no question about it. There was a letter written by one of the activists, Ursula, who you may remember, you've heard her on the air before. She's an older woman who was severely embarrassed and upset, understandably, by an incident where a business, Ross, of all people, the same people that's pushed to put up the fence around the parking lot, has security guards roaming the area, harassing people, bringing water into the Ross camp. I don't know if it's simply Ross, or even if Ross is specifically engaged in it, but I would make the guess that their fingers are in this somewhere. In any case, Ursula is concerned about having some open bathrooms, and she's been involved in protests, as have many of us with Conscience in Action, at the Loudon Nelson Center, in front of Parks and Rec's offices, in front of the city manager's office. We met with the city manager. We've been able to get the San Lorenzo bathrooms open after they were closed for a year, though I'm not sure where they're at now. But we haven't been able to get 24-hour bathrooms other than the three porta-potties that are available downtown, and then the line of porta-potties that's available out at Ross. Not the most convenient thing for homeless people throughout the city, for sure, or for that matter, for late-night tourists or people who are just passing through. So her question was sent to activist Micah Posner, who was on the city council for 4 years, and got a lot of flack for me for what he didn't do and some of the things he did do and some commendation for some of the things he did do, like with Pamela Comstock. Talk about doing deals with the devil. Opening a 24-hour porta-potty, what I call the Posner poo-poo machine or the Posner porta-potty, at the corner of Front and Laurel Streets. But not opening the bathrooms, which he also was able with her to actually open the bathrooms. Yeah, let me clarify that. He was the one who got the porta potty there, but then he and Comstock were able to get the parking garage bathroom across from New Leaf Market, the Front Street garage, opened one of the Front Street garages. Front Street has a couple of them. So good for him on that. She wrote him to ask who originally decided to close the bathrooms and what's going on there. This is one of the things that Drew Glover was concerned about in his resolution, essentially getting the city council to reopen the bathrooms that are closed and also establish a procedure by which the city parks and rec boss, Tony Elliott, or in the old days, Mauro Garcia, or before that, Dennett Shoemaker, could just arbitrarily, with a snap of her fingers, close the stuff without even really consulting with even the Parks and Rec Commission. Although I think she has to advise them it's happening, but it's not, she doesn't, there's no control over her. Similar to the city manager, who has no control, really, except in theory from the city council. But once the city council, will it ever get the ovaries or the balls to fire this guy? All they need to do is put the resolution on the agenda and pass it with 4 votes. And they have 4 votes. So if you're wondering what's happening, so am I. Anyway, the letter from Ursula to Micah Posner about the issue of the bathrooms reads as follows. Actually, she just sent him a very quick email. And what he said was, if I can find the damn thing, I would like to know who proposed the idea and voted to make it policy, the closing of the Loudon Nelson bathrooms. At which point, Posner responded, according to city ordinance, the parks director has the right to open and close city facilities. I doubt this was drafted with politics in mind. The charter is much older than the beginnings of policies that marginalize and harass homeless people. I believe that the new parks director is closing facilities in close consultation with the city manager, or in the case of the Loudon Nelson bathroom, keeping them closed. They've been closed since February of last year. And by closed, I mean they are locked under a key that is only available to those who are at the Loudon Nelson Center, supposedly using a particular program. And people who have actually been using the programs have been denied access at different points. If you ask the staff, they don't all agree with this, although you'll get ambivalent answers from people like Skidmark Bob Duran, who talks about vandalism in the bathrooms. When you examine that excuse and look for the actual specifics of the vandalism, how many times it's happened, how much expense it's caused, you find it relatively a small number of times, two or three times a year maybe. Less, actually, I think, in 2017, the year, or 2018, the year before it was closed. No, 2017. And anyway, the letter continues, the better fix, Micah Posner writes, is for the city council to control when parks are open. Given the closures are now being done as a way to attempt to control parts of the population and not just for maintenance, this would be more in keeping with the city's charter. I wrote an ordinance to this effect. Sandy Brown and Drew Glover are strongly in support and have agreed to bring it to the council in the next few months. I believe that Crone and Cummings also supported it. I've attached it for your review. And indeed, many of us sat down at the table with Drew Glover and tried to have this ordinance put together along with six or seven others. And they were all sidelined several times. Finally, two of them got put on the agenda, the homeless emergency and the Delaware parking, which was apparently only a part of it was put on the ordinance, and that resulted in a panic among the Delaware people, Delaware Street residents, or those who are in the general area, or possibly group mobilized by those who just hate the idea of homeless people being able to park their RVs or vehicles anywhere in Santa Cruz. And there are quite a number of those, at least in an active minority. I call them the Take Back Santa Cruz trolls, but They're predated by downtown neighbors, Santa Cruz neighbors, the police department, the staff, the downtown association, and so forth. In the meantime, Micah Posner continues in his letter back to Ursula, the parks director could simply open the bathrooms and get rid of the damn fascist fence in San Lorenzo Park, or the city manager could ask him to do it, or they could check in with four council members and then do it instead of waiting to be publicly directed to do so. So it doesn't even require council action. All it does is requires four council members, I mean, really probably will require four council members to do it because the city manager and the head of Parks and Rec are not so inclined. But good for you, Ursula, for pursuing this, and good for you, Micah, for clarifying your thoughts on this and speaking out, my, using the F word, fascist, goodness gracious. Let's not get extreme. And now it's time for a famed musical break, and perhaps to everyone's delight, although we'll see. I haven't heard this song. This is going to be the first time I've heard it. It's another one from Randy Rainbow.
I'm here now with the latest cast-off from The Bachelor Hanoi, fresh off his second meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I don't see a rose. Does that mean no denuclearization?
We didn't sign anything today. It didn't quite work out.
Did you guys do it?
I just don't think maybe either of us were ready.
So does that mean we can expect a third date?
We'll see what happens. Again, the relationship is very good. He likes me. I like him. Some people say, oh, you shouldn't like him. I said, why shouldn't I like him?
Maybe because he's a deranged dictator who starves his people and executes members of his own family. But, you know, we all have... My boyfriend doesn't put down the toilet seat, so... Men!
Well, no, I just think he's... First of all, he's a character.
What's your response to critics who accuse you of consistently siding with foreign adversaries over your own intelligence officials?
Why shouldn't I like him? I like him. Get along great.
Uh-huh. And what do you say to those who worry that your naivete and reckless behavior are jeopardizing national security and putting us all in grave danger?
We'll see what happens. Again, the relationship is very good.
You would think he'd obey when his own intel agencies tell him to watch out for Putin and Kim.
He's a real personality, and he's very smart. He's sharp as you can be, and he's a real leader.
But he's too egocentric to do what those men think is best for the country instead of for him.
He likes me. I like him.
Some people say, oh, you shouldn't like him. I said, why shouldn't I like him?
Yet he's as obedient as a tiny pup or any louse on a nuclear list.
Look, bottom line, I think he wants to get something done.
But when his own daddy issues start flaring up, there's not a psychopath he can resist.
He's sharp as he can be, and he's a real leader.
So unabashedly he reveals.
And he's very smart.
He's so sad. Lovely feelings he feels. He gets horny for absolute power. Treacherous goons put a gleam in his eye. His taste in men stinks. Now he says that he thinks he's in love and we're all gonna die. Goes mad for a mad crazy tyrant who rapes and pillages, murders and lies. Merely faux pas he lets slide just because he's in love with these wonderful guys. Of a snitch under oath on a witch hunt or anyone who disagrees. He's a hater but ruthless dictator, sure make him go weak in the knees. He goes cuckoo for criminal con men, what they're all selling he's eager to buy. And while they play him he's happy to say he's in love, he's in love, he's in love, he's in love, he's in love.
And then we fell in love.
Hey,
no really, he wrote me beautiful letters, and they're great letters.
Sure it seems treasony, but can't you see he's in love. He gets misty for misogynists. He gives dirtbags the credit they're due. At a summit, he plays it so dumb. It's no wonder they all love him too. He gets boners for bloodthirsty monsters. He'll take their side every time they deny. Oh, he's appalled when it comes to a bog. When he loves autocratic, tyrannical, lying, oppressive.
I like him.
Great.
And that was Randy Rainbow. He's in love and we're all going to die. Just a couple comments. Rainbow's touching packing with Democratic Party hacks who have now decided the FBI and the CIA are the best source because they're against Trump as well is really an unwise choice in my view. We're not in real danger. The idea of a deal with North Korea and a peace treaty with South Korea is a good idea, not a bad idea, though not a likely situation considering Trump's general hawkish constituency. He's a showman. He does what he does in order to distract from what he doesn't want seen and to garner support with his constituency. So, you know, but using that, however, understanding that you don't want to attack and become a warmonger against Russia and peace activity across the globe because Trump happens to be talking that way or seems to be making motions in that direction. That's a bad idea, particularly even more so to put your faith in the CIA and the FBI. That's my view. Anyway, coming up next, we have a relatively long segment of Anthony Prince's presentation to Roskamp sympathizers, Roskamp residents, homeless activists, in a meeting that happened yesterday. This is going to be the first part, and I'll be playing more, I think, on Sunday. It's going to break off rather abruptly, so be prepared for that. And if you want more of it, check in at 9:30 on Sunday on this same computer dial at freakradio.org. I don't think we're going to have any transmitting happening yet by that time. I'd love to be proved wrong. Again, if you have any tips on where to find a studio space or a transmitter site, you want to offer anything, any ideas, give me a call, 423-4833. If you have any comments on the show that you want to pass on, memorials for Sherry Connable or anybody else who's died. A couple of homeless guys have died, three actually, recently in the last few months. Let me know. 423-4833. And I'll be talking at you again on Sunday.
Okay. So, thank you. thank you guys for coming here today. And what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about what we're doing with the Homeless Union. Some of you know a little bit about what we've been doing. Unfortunately, Brian Brown and Raylan Butcher, who are in charge of our union in Marysville, are still busy with the aftermath of the storms. It's been a very hectic situation where they've been trying to, as best they can, attend to our members up there on the river, on the levees, and down by the river bottoms. And then I was hoping Wes could be here today, but you know Wes, he's all over the place. We had a meeting with the manager, the city manager of a little town called Seaside, near Marina, not too far from Monterey. And actually a pretty productive meeting, frankly. And so I'll tell you guys a little bit about that, or he would have been here today. So today I'm going to go through, we'll talk a little bit about the union, talk a little bit about what we're doing here. And then I'm going to just make a presentation. What I was asked to do is talk about two major things. One, the whole area of how one files a pro se lawsuit. How someone not represented by counsel can nevertheless file and prosecute a civil action. I was very surprised, and have been surprised, at a few locations where we tell people this, that they can file their own lawsuit, and people say they didn't know that they could do that, which is just kind of a sad commentary on how lawyer-heavy the society is. And it's also the reality that it's like, well, you don't got a lawyer, you don't stand a chance. But the fact of the matter is that people do have the right to file their own lawsuits, do all the time, defend themselves in court and administrative hearings all the time, and prevail more times than you might otherwise think. And I'm going to give some examples of that in a minute. But before we get started, I got to have a little water. A water thing here.
I didn't bring any glasses.
Okay,
I'll go get some.
Maybe there's some cups.
There's a cup of water. Someone could help me with that.
Have you started the recording?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I just also wanted to ask people, this is personal for me, if we could keep all interruptions to a minimum, please, so that we can really listen well to the opportunity we have with Mr. Prince. I just really appreciate that.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I guess we are, come on in. I guess we are recording today. What we discussed was, we'll go ahead and record, and then if it appears from the course of the discussion that there are certain parts of the recording that we don't want to make public or be otherwise available, we will edit the recording.
I just have a quick pragmatic question to clarify what you already said. You said there's two major things that you want to present on after the homeless union.
Yeah.
And one I heard was how one can file a pro se lawsuit.
That's right.
And what was the second one?
I didn't get to it yet.
Okay.
All right.
I want to be very organized because
he's not always
going to be able to come. He's actually told us that he can't really represent us because he's already got too much work.
Well, let me go ahead and make my presentation, and we'll go forward. So first things first, I've got name tags, and I have folders, and I have notebook paper. So I'm going to pass this stuff around. If you guys want to take some notes, you're welcome to keep the folders, keep your notes in the folders. I'm going to have a couple little handouts, and I have pens if you need them. So I'm just going to pass the whole packet around, and I encourage you to take notes. This is what we do. We've had a number of these trainings in different parts of California that our union has put on to teach people how to file their own lawsuits or represent themselves in court, and this is what we do. So I'm going to do the same format here. So I'm going to start that going around, and also I'm going to start going around a name tag. Okay? Hello, my name is Anthony. I'm going to put mine on right here. This is convenient. If you forget your name, you just look down like this here, and you go, my name is Niru, not just kidding. Okay, so let me pass those out to you. And it would help me if you could write your names nice and big so I can see them, so I can get to know everybody. Okay? Thanks for the water, whoever brought in the water. Thank you. So first things first, little introduction about myself very quickly. my name is Anthony Prince. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and have spent my entire life since I was pretty much a kid in the social justice struggles. My dad was a World War II veteran, disabled vet from World War II, came back, and he was in the 10th Mountain Division. He became very active in social justice causes in the 40s and 50s. And my mom, 88 years old, just walked a picket line in Los Angeles because she's a special education teacher, and as you know, the teachers won their strike.
They did.
They did. So, we're going to get rid of all these calls.
Everybody's in airplane mode.
Yeah. And so I spent my whole life pretty much as just a blue-collar guy with working-class background, but I didn't go to college, but I had a chance when I was in my early 40s to go to law school. And so I skipped college. Who needs that? So I went straight to law school 20 years after getting out of high school. But I do have a lot of background of the University of the Streets, the University of the Workplace. And I was the youngest chief steward in the Teamsters, in the history of the Teamsters Union when I was 17 years old. So I've spent time in the unions. I've spent time organizing. And I go back 35 years ago, to the National Union of the Homeless. Some of you may remember the National Union of the Homeless. We had, at one time, 35,000 members in 25 cities. And we were quite a force to be reckoned with. We were the ones that marched on October 7th, 1989, and forced Jack Kemp, he was Secretary of HUD at that time, forced Jack Kemp to allocate 10% of all HUD homes to the homeless. Of course, he reneged on that agreement soon after he made it. But nevertheless, we were able to accomplish quite a bit at a time when homelessness was kind of a cause celebrate. You remember Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal and Robin Williams had comic relief, and the whole of society was very concerned and very wanted to do something. Well, we live in a totally different environment. I don't have to tell you guys that the homeless are now a despised class, a despised marginalized population, and there's a war against the homeless. And our view is that the homelessness is just the most visible expression of poverty. So what's happening to the so-called homeless is just the entry point to a broader attack on all poor people, of which there's 8 million in California living at or below the poverty line. Okay, so is everyone putting on their name tags? I see they're great.
I'm waiting for one to show up.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, yeah.
I want to get yourself a name tags and paper and folders and going around if you want to, and pens. Okay, so the Homeless Union,
dead pen.
So I just pass these around. It's always risky when you pass something out, because people start reading it and they don't listen to you anymore. But I'm going to pass it out anyway, and we'll just go through it very, very quickly.
Are all the pens being used?
Oh, you can take one of the paper you need. The pens, I have more pens. Anyone
else
have
pens?
This one's dead. It's dead.
Want some paper then?
There you go.
And there's a... there should be enough folders for everybody. Maybe not. Have a seat.
Go ahead. This pen isn't working.
Oh, pens. Yeah. Here's the pens. You got to kind of scrape off the ball
right,
and get it going. These are not the most fancy pens or fanciest pens. You got to kind of get them going a little bit. So you got to kind of peel the ball off. And then get it going.
Yeah.
Like a little piece of plastic on the edge of the ball, so you gotta feel it. Okay.
There we go.
Okay, now just kind of maybe once you pass those around.
There it is.
And very quickly,
plastic protector.
I'll just give a very brief overview. The union, as I say, some of us, and we're kind of situated in different parts of the country, go back to the old National Union. But more recently here in California, we began in Salinas 5 years ago when we filed a federal lawsuit to stop the city of Salinas from breaking up the largest homeless encampment in that city. And that was on Soledad Street in the old Chinatown section of town. We never did get that court to issue an injunction, but we did force the city to stop enforcing this ordinance. And step by step, we got to a position where we had at least an ability to push back and call attention to what was going on. But the most significant outcome of that whole battle was the establishment of the union. We like to say we lost that battle, but we took a step towards winning the war. And to this day, almost 5 years later, the union is still there in Salinas. Wes White, you guys, how many of you guys know Wes White?
We know Wes.
All right. No. Wes White is the president of the union. Just this last year, Wes ran for mayor, and at the last minute he decided he didn't want to run for mayor, and threw his support to another guy who had been somewhat supportive of us, but it was too late to take Wes's name off the ballot, and so despite the fact that he had publicly thrown his support to another guy, he got 7,000 votes for mayor of the city of Salinas.
Wow.
7,000 votes for a person that everybody knows is homeless and represents the homeless union. I say that's pretty significant.
Okay.
So from our standpoint, even though we didn't prevail ultimately in the federal court to get the injunction, we were able to establish the union and to begin to make a real difference in Salinas. And Ed Fry is here. I should also point out Ed Fry. You guys know Ed. I met Ed. Ed and I worked together when they tried to keep Wes White off the ballot. He ran for city council before he ran for mayor. So we filed what's called a writ of mandate, which we'll talk about in a minute. We filed what's called a writ of mandate to try to get the court to order Monterey County, the voter officials, to put his name on the ballot. Unfortunately, however, it was too close to the election. It was this national election, 2016. And the judge said she simply couldn't bring herself to recall all the ballots and reprint the ballots and compromise the voting rights of millions of people, supposedly, in Monterey County, however number of people there are in Monterey County. So the voting rights of poor people and homeless people were sacrificed so that everybody else could vote. But we were encouraged in that case because she put a little footnote, and sometimes in a legal case a footnote is very significant. And she put a footnote saying that as far as she was concerned, she was very troubled that the city of Salinas, with its restrictions and its ordinances, had effectively disfranchised poor and homeless people. So we were encouraged by that at least. And Ed and I teamed up to get that, to file that writ of mandate. And then it also made it a little bit easier when Wes did run for mayor. They were a little more reluctant to try to keep him off the ballot. So even when you lose, sometimes you win, right? Okay.
So good, they need to be taken away.
So the union, this is kind of self-explanatory, just a very short handout that we give to people when they say, what is the homeless union? And we just give them this along with other materials, so you guys can keep that. I got to make a disclaimer. What I'm going to talk about today is not legal advice. I don't represent anybody here. You have to say that sometimes because very oftentimes a lawyer will address a group of people, and next thing you know, and it's not hard to understand, they feel, well, this guy's representing me or this woman's representing me. And that can become problematic. So what I'm going to talk about today is we're going to talk a lot about the law, but it's not specific legal advice to any individual. However, having said that, I'm ready to talk about, and I hope we do talk about, some legal steps that can be taken right here in Santa Cruz to stop them from breaking up this camp, at least before they can provide actual habitable dwelling for everybody in that camp. We'll talk about that. So... So the first thing I want to do is ask everyone, or just let you know, I think you guys know, this is this word right here is a Latin word. You guys know what this means?
For oneself.
And so a pro se, someone who's a pro se defendant, that's they're charged with something under the law, or some, they be given a ticket or an infraction, or they're charged with a misdemeanor or some kind of crime. They don't have a lawyer, but they appear in court and they defend themselves. They're a pro se defendant. On the other hand, if you are have some civil wrong that has happened to you or is about to happen to you, and you can't get a lawyer, or you can't find a lawyer to represent you, and you represent yourself, you file your own lawsuit, you appear in court on your own behalf, you are a pro se plaintiff. Okay, and I want to show you an example of where's that big box I have? An example of what a pro se plaintiff can do. And this is just one of about three dozen files that was put together by Brian Lee Brown, president of our Marysville homeless union. I'm going to pass this around. I'll show you. You guys have seen legal pleadings, right? Usually they're typed out and nicely, with a nice appearance. This is what Brian Brown did.
He created his own form?
He wrote his own complaints.
Pardon
me?
It's not even a standard form.
This actually is the correct form.
Oh, okay.
This is the correct form. What I'm trying to say is it's not all that difficult. People are oftentimes completely frightened and scared away when you bring up the idea of filing your own lawsuit because, well, geez, I don't have access to a computer. I don't have all those forms. I don't have that paper with the number down the side, which is called pleading paper. How can I do this? Here's evidence that it can be done. Brian prosecuted his own lawsuit after they broke up 7 homeless camps on the Yuba River in 2016. Wow. And so he could not find any lawyer to represent him, and so he filed his own lawsuit, and it was in the courts for 9 months. We found out about it. Unfortunately, the case was going to be almost on the edge of being dismissed, but we found out about it, we stepped in, and now as legal counsel for the union, I'm also representing Brian in the case. But I'm going to pass this around. And again, just to give you an idea of what's possible, this, and you can see that this file is just filled with evidence, motions, pleadings. Brian was able to research this, how to file a lawsuit. You go online, you can find a lot of good, helpful materials, how to file a lawsuit in state court or in federal court. He did all these things. So what's the message? The message is that even if you're poor, even if you're homeless, even if you don't have those resources, you still have access to that court system, but you've got to fight your way into it. So pro se is what we're talking about today, and it means for yourself. And we in the homeless union believe that I don't have to tell you guys, there are not a lot of lawyers who are willing to take these cases. Every once in a while I see the ACLU or the pro bono department of a big law firm or some dedicated civil rights attorneys. You got people like Ed Fry who's been doing this a whole life. But unfortunately, Ed's the exception and not the rule for the legal community, which ought to be stepping up significantly as this crisis and this war on the homeless unfolds. And that's especially true given the fact we just got a very favorable decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that decision is, you guys know what that decision is? People heard about this decision?
Martin versus Boise.
Is it separate from the Bell versus Boise case, or did it just get split off?
Bell and Martin were both plaintiffs.
They were both plaintiffs, and he carried on.
His case went forward after the Bell case was resolved differently. That's my understanding.
My understanding, the Bell case wasn't resolved.
I think they had a settlement with the Bell case.
Did they?
They're wrong.
Okay.
Anyway, this is the decision. This is the case. And it's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The way the federal system works is you have district courts, and then you have courts of appeal. And then you have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals represents 11, I think it's 11 states in the western region of the country. And so the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on September 4th of last year issued this decision. In a nutshell, the decision says that cities and counties or government agents or government bodies of any type cannot criminalize, they cannot sanction, arrest, ticket, cite you for doing something that's just a natural, unavoidable consequence of being a human being. They cannot stop you from being on the city streets, doing those things, sleeping, eating, performing bodily functions, being present, resting. They cannot prevent you from doing those things on public spaces unless they're able to provide shelter. They have to provide that shelter before they can enforce any ordinance or statute which would ordinarily make it an infraction or a crime to be on a public space when you're not supposed to be there. So it's a pretty good decision. Yeah.
Question. What I read up on the decision when it happened. Some of the ordinances, which were local and not state-related, read just like the 647E California lodging law that the court was ruling on. Has this Martin versus Boise affected 647E, where the state basically claims ownership of any piece of property that's not otherwise claimed?
I would see. This is why I hate coming to these meetings. You got guys like this who know more than I.
Well, but there were a bunch of people here that were subject to 640.
Well, I would say I'd have to look at it, but I would say that Martin versus Boise encompasses. It's pretty broad.
The logic.
Now it does have exceptions, and there are ways around it, and cities are finding ways around it. For example, if you are trespassing, they can cite you for trespass. If you are doing some other act which they say is a threat to public health and safety, maybe they can cite you for that. So there's ways around it. But I would say generally, it's a real opening. We're not going to have it for very long. But while we do have it, you would think that we'd have a lot more lawyers stepping in on some of these cases, because half the cities in California are totally ignoring Martin versus Boise, and the other half are trying to find some way around it.
Sacramento.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about the case. Opinion in that case, the court makes it clear. Let me read the exact words from the opinion. It says, "Our holding is a narrow one, like the Jones panel." Jones was the Jones in L.A. case that got settled several years ago, even though the Court of Appeal had issued a really favorable to the homeless ruling. Like the Jones panel, quote, "We in no way dictate to the city that it must provide sufficient shelter for the homeless." In other words, you're free to go out and trespass, but we're not going to tell you where you can sleep. And if we don't like the way you're trespassing, we can bust you.
My kind of understanding of what's happened, and it's a cynical point of view because I'm houseless, is what the feds basically did is they washed their hands of any responsibility to act. Do anything about homelessness because it's not illegal anymore.
Well, let me tell you what our perspective is on this case. And I Ed's right. The decision itself talks about it's narrow. And you're also right that to a certain extent it provides a lot of exceptions. But I'll tell you something. It's an opening. And when you're fighting a war like we're fighting, you take every possible advantage that you can get. I'll give you an example. Just last week or 2 weeks ago when the rains were falling in Marysville, Brian and Ray Lynn and some of the other union members in Marysville were bringing people to the parking lot of the St. John's Episcopal Church, which has been very supportive of the union, taking them off the rivers and putting river bottoms and taking them so they could survive right in the church parking lot. So two squad cars from Marysville Police Department pulled up and walked into the parking lot and told Brian, "Hey, you guys can't be here. You got to get these campers. You got to get these tents. You got to get them out of here. You guys can't be here." So Brian jumped up and said, "Hey, you must have not heard about Martin versus Boise, because you can't do that under Martin versus Boise. We have a right to be here unless you got some place to put us. You have a place to put us, and there is no shelter space available in the city of Marysville." And so the police then said, "Oh, well, we'll see about that." And they walked into the church, supposedly to tell Pastor Phillips that these people had to go. And about 10 minutes later, the cops got in their squad cars and left, and those tents and those trailers are still in that church parking lot. So I'd like to say that Brian Lee Brown is not a lawyer, and the policeman was not a lawyer either. And Brian was able to take the little opening of Martin versus Boise and use it as a way to at least, for that moment, preserve the ability to protect homeless people. See what I'm saying? I understand the weaknesses. I understand all these things. We're never going to have laws that are passed by our adversaries which automatically give us these rights. What we have to do is like tacking into the wind. You know, you've seen these boats that manage to go when the winds are blowing the opposite direction. They still manage to steer where they got to go. They manage to tack their way through all these prevailing winds to get where they got to go. And that's how we look at this thing. So our perception of Martin versus Boise is it's an opening, let's use it, but at the same time, these brothers are saying, it certainly is not a be-all, end-all, and it has quite a few exceptions, so we can't completely rely upon it. What we have to rely upon is what we do, and not simply leave it to someone else to protect our rights. Okay.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Is there a working definition of shelter? For example, if a city like Santa Cruz builds a structure that 6-foot-tall wire fences with barbed wire on the top with controlled access with a guard, and you can only come in until 6, blah, blah, blah.
We're going to get to that.
That prison structure.
Hold that question. We're going to get to that.
I could say that
we're going to get to that.
That DOJ intent brief they issued in Bell versus Boise spelled out what it isn't, which I considered really fascinating.
Yeah.
They spelled that word qualified as not.
That was an opinion from the U.S. Justice Department when Vinita Gupta was head of the Civil Rights Division under President Obama. It's a pretty good friend of the court brief that they filed before the Martin vs. Boise came out. But anyway, we'll get to that. Hold that question because we're going to talk about that. All right, so we touched on Martin versus Boise. My understanding of the current situation right here in Santa Cruz is that you have this encampment. We were out there last week. By the way, we have people who live in the encampment here with us?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. So be sure to, you know, weigh in, raise your hands, and fill us in what's going on as we have this discussion, okay? But my understanding is that it's out there. The city has given a deadline of March 15th to vacate, but at the same time, there's been discussion on the city council that maybe they'll push that date back. They're trying to get around Martin versus Boise, or at least hold out the prospect that they will have shelter for everybody so they can justify coming in and shutting down the camp. That's basically, in a nutshell, what we're looking at. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll get back to that and get back to the specifics in a minute. But let's talk about an injunction. So there's two kinds of injunctions. First of all, let's talk about what an injunction is. Who can tell me what an injunction is?
It stops the government from doing something or someone from doing something.
Right. So, and you know, the root word is enjoin, which means that you are prevented from doing something, and that's how we get injunction. And there's two kinds of injunctions. There's a mandatory injunction and there's two kinds.
Prohibitory injunction.
Prohibitive injunction and mandatory injunction. Mandatory injunction is when you're trying to get the court to order, usually a government agency, to do what they're supposed to do. That's what we did when Wes White was trying to run for city council, and they wouldn't put him on the ballot. We sued the Monterey County voter registrar and said, we want the court to order you to put Wes White's name on the ballot. That would have been a mandatory injunction. A prohibitive injunction is, is you want the court to order some person or some official to stop doing what they're doing or what they're about to do. So when we talk about an injunction, what we're saying is that, and we always use this example, there's a lot of examples you can use. Here's your house, and all of a sudden a truck pulls up and they're going to dump toxic waste on your front lawn the next morning, and you want to stop them from doing that. And so you might think, well, I'm going to go to court and try to prevent this from happening. And the court might say, well, if they dump their toxic material on your lawn, you can always sue them and get some damages and plant a new lawn. So that's not something that's irrevocable. That's not something that's an irretrievable loss. You can kind of get that back. And there's some truth to that. You can see with me that's true. But what if the toxic material that they're going to dump on your lawn is going to make its way immediately into the water supply? It's going to penetrate your plumbing down there and poison your family. Well, then it doesn't matter if you can come into court later and sue them and get money damages so you can rebuild your house. Your family's at risk for being poisoned the very next day, right? So when you are trying to convince the court that, hey, we can't wait for there to be a full-blown trial, you need to act right now, because if you don't act right now, it will be too late. The harm that's going to happen to us is irreversible. We'll suffer irreversible harm if the court doesn't intervene right now. So that's what, basically, in a nutshell, an injunction is an order from the court to stop doing something that they're either already doing or they're about to do. Okay? So, for example, here, if we were to talk about trying to get an injunction against the city of Santa Cruz, it would be, we want to stop you from breaking up that camp, because if you do break up that camp, harm will come to the residents of that camp, and the harm that will come to them will be irreversible. It will be harms that cannot be compensated later in court. And we've had this experience. I want to tell you, and you guys know this, we have seen across California where we have union locals, where they break up these encampments and people are scattered to the winds, we have injury and we have death. And we have physical injury, especially to the women. In Salinas, when they broke up the camp on Soledad Street. Within a few days, we had two rapes that were committed, and it was because the women, two of the women who had been in the community and had some modicum of safety because it was a community looking after each other, they were then exiled out into the farther reaches of Monterey County, and two of them got raped.
It also damages the surrounding community. What's going to happen as soon as they break up that camp, everybody's going to scatter into the neighborhoods and harm the surrounding housed community.
Well, see, but the harm you're talking about is not the harm that might happen to someone else or the community.
You can't bring up harm to others. It has to be to you directly.
Well, I would not bring up...
Society.
I would not make the argument that by homeless people coming to the community, they're going to harm the community.
No.
That's not an argument you want to make.
But that's not the argument. It harms their property value and their gentrification, and it causes an interest on all those, at least the way they visualize
right,
it.
Right. Well, you're articulating the viewpoint of the so-called homeowners association.
Yeah.
Fearful.
You can play them to be on your side that way.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. Let me kind of go through this here, and we'll kind of sort these things out. Okay.
Can you define the meaning of plaintiff? Before you go,
yes.
Just real quickly.
Yeah, so a plaintiff is, like Elise is doing, you have any question about any word or term I'm using, just talk about, hey, what does that mean, and we'll answer it. So plaintiff is, the root word of plaintiff, of course, or a word that sounds very similar, is complaint, right? So if you're complaining about something, you have a complaint, you're a plaintiff. So the plaintiff is the party or the organization or who has a complaint, and they go into court, they're sort of like taking the offensive. They're coming in to do something to someone else or make some other party do something or sue some party because they've done something wrong to them. So they're the plaintiff, and they have the burden of proof. In other words, they're the ones who have to prove their case. They have to prove that what happened to them actually happened and who is at fault and that they're entitled to some kind of relief. The other category is defendant, and that's a little bit easier to understand because it means that they are the ones who have to defend the lawsuit. So if we sued the city of Salinas 5 years ago, it was Rita Acosta was our lead plaintiff. We had seven plaintiffs, Acosta and others, versus city of Salinas. So we were the plaintiffs, and the city of Salinas was the defendant. Okay, so that's what, in a nutshell, what an injunction is. And there's, in California, if you want to get an injunction, if you want to convince a court to issue an injunction, there's three things that you have to show. Okay, and the first thing is, well, let me explain this. The injunction has to be tied to a lawsuit. In other words, you can't, in most cases, just simply go into court and say, hey, I want to stop this person from doing this or stop this organization or this government official from doing this thing. There has to be an underlying lawsuit, okay? For example, when we sued, again, I'm going to use Salinas because that's one we have most experience with. When we sued the city of Salinas, we did two things at the same time. We asked for an injunction to stop them from enforcing this ordinance. The ordinance would have allowed them to confiscate and destroy property belonging to homeless people just by saying it's dirty, broken, or in disrepair. They can just seize your property and get rid of it immediately.
So you have to file a suit before you...
They don't have to do anything. They had the authority under this ordinance to just seize your property. You had no due process. You couldn't complain. They wouldn't store it. They destroy it. If it was dirty, broken, or in disrepair. I don't know about you guys, but a lot of stuff I have in my house is broken, dirty, and in disrepair. I got a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old. I'm in their rooms, and you're going to find a lot of dirty, broken, and in disrepair.
I'm trying to make sure I understand that you have to have a lawsuit filed before you can file an injunction.
No, that's not necessarily true. You don't have to have a lawsuit filed before. You can go in for an injunctive relief and file a lawsuit simultaneously. Okay? And that's what we did. So what you have to do is to go back to Salinas, we sued the city for violation of civil rights, our federal civil rights, for violation of the Fifth Amendment. They took property without due process. Violation of the Fourth Amendment. which is search and seizure, that they seize property belonging to homeless people and without a warrant and without a probable cause to seize that property. So that was our underlying lawsuit. So let me write this down. Here's a lawsuit. Okay, and that's the underlying. In other words, here's your complaint. Here's your legal complaint. But you got your legal complaint, and that's going to go work its way through the courts, and you'll call witnesses, and you'll have to prove, you'll have to make your legal arguments, you have to show that your property was taken without permission, that it was destroyed, you didn't have due process, you didn't have your rights respected, right? So that's the lawsuit. But
what do you get from that?
Pardon me?
What do you get from that?
From filing the lawsuit?
If you can prove that. Made whole.
Yeah, well, it's being made whole. For example, if your property is stolen, well, there's several things you can get from that, from filing a civil rights lawsuit with all those different constitutional claims. First of all, you can get compensated for whatever it was that was destroyed or seized or made so that you can't use it anymore. You can actually have the value of that in damages. If your car was destroyed because a truck smashed into it, and you sue the trucking company, and you get what they call compensatory damages to compensate you for the value of that truck. But you can also get other types of damages. And in a civil rights lawsuit where your rights are violated, you can get money damages. You can get a money award. A court can award money damages for the violation of your civil rights. The violation, your civil rights have value. They have money value. And so you can actually get to answer your question. That's what you can get if you prevail, if you win a civil rights lawsuit. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Last year, I think just to go on my stuff, my green cards and everything, I don't know what happened to the stuff. But I asked him if I can go pick him up, but I haven't. And then the president let me go out there.
Okay, tell me again what happened. I didn't get all.
They stole my things. I just came and stole my stuff.
This is at the camp?
In the camp, not here, but there were political shoes behind the fence.
At another place?
Yeah.
Okay. Who took your things?
The
police?
I guess. They
ring?
Let me go across the, go back there and grab him.
Okay.
But somebody was there. And a person was there in the camp. And she took her stuff and left.
They took your papers, they took your personal things. Okay, well, what they did, if they didn't have a warrant to take those things, if the things you had were not posing any risk of harm to anybody, and they weren't contraband, they weren't things that they knew had been stolen, then they had no right to take your possessions. And that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment, seizure. They had no justification for that. Fifth Amendment, which is the federal statute, but through the 14th Amendment, it applies to the states. 14th Amendment, due process. They didn't give you a chance to argue, hey, don't take my things. And after they took your things, they didn't give you a chance to get your things back, right? Okay, so those are some of the things, some of the violations that they committed. We'll talk more about that as we go through it. But I'm sorry that happened. And I would suggest that while it's still fresh in your mind, to write down everything that they took from you. And if you have other people who knew you had those things, if you have friends that say, oh yeah, what's your name again, brother?
Bruno.
Pardon me?
Bruno.
If you have friends that can say, yeah, I saw him with this item, I saw him, I know he had his ID because I saw it. In other words, if you have witnesses, that's good evidence. That shows it's not your word against whoever took your stuff, but you have witnesses. See what I'm saying? But right now, what you ought to do, and I recommend this for everybody, anything like that happens in the camps, write it down immediately.
Film it while it's happening.
Pardon me?
Film it while it's happening.
Film it while it's happening. Write it down. You know, we say if it isn't written down, it didn't happen. You should always try to make a written record of every single thing that happens. If I have a conversation, like for example, we had a conversation with the deputy city attorney in Salinas when we were trying to negotiate a resolution of our lawsuit. And the deputy city attorney said, I said, look, why don't we just put the whole lawsuit aside and we'll have someone from our side walk with someone from the city. We'll walk the whole camp, and if you see an individual campsite that has a health and safety problem, we'll deal with it. That's better than destroying the whole camp. You know, you should evaluate each person individually. And he agreed. He said, well, you know, that's a good plan. I said, I think, let's do that. I immediately went back and I immediately sent him an email confirming the agreement. Say, this is to confirm, this is to memorialize the agreement that you and I entered into yesterday that we discussed. With regard to, we'll have individualized inspections. We agree to put the lawsuit on hold. You agree to put any plan to destroy the camp on hold. And we'll just go, you know, individual by individual, and we'll solve the problems. We don't want fire hazards. We don't want people blocking fire hydrants. We don't want streets to be obstructed. We can resolve all those things. You don't have to destroy this whole encampment to take care of those things. So I sent him the confirming email. The next day, I got an email back from him, and not from him, but from the city attorney, Chris Callahan. And I can't remember this deputy attorney's last name. They fired him.
Yep.
He was no longer deputy city attorney.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
A young guy, young attorney, who just wanted to do the right thing, and apparently he thought he had the authority to enter into an agreement with me, and they got rid of him. But I was able to argue that the city had still entered into a binding agreement because I had that email.
Did it work?
No. But it became evidence. It became evidence of the city's lack of good faith. I mean, let me say something, because you're bringing these things up.
I assume that automatically.
Hang on. Let's define what winning means. Let's define what losing means. Let's define what it means to get something and what it means not to get something. Because I'm telling you, we're going to lose most of these battles. We have lost most of them, and we're going to lose most of them.
Harassment tactics.
The point is that win, lose, or draw, we have to participate in these fights in such a way as to constantly build our strength, to develop a movement. And for us, that means building out the homeless union. Because we have to be mindful of the fact that they have the overwhelming superiority of forces now. They got the police, they got the law, they got the codes, they got the ordinances. We might have a temporary thing with a decision here and there, but it's only going to be temporary, and we know that. And that's why our union is digging in for the long haul. We're about building a movement now. And everything we do is about building the movement. And I'm going to tell you guys, frankly, that when we had our lawsuit in Salinas, it attracted a lot of attention in the legal community. And next thing you know, some of these big shot lawyers came in.
Yep.
I won't name any names, but some of these big shot lawyers from big corporate law firms.
The ACLU shows up.
I'm not talking about the ACLU. I'm talking about some lawyers from big shot, big corporate law firms. They have their pro bono department, and they came in and said, we want to co-counsel with you on this case. Okay, that's fine. They had resources that we didn't have. They had staff that we didn't have, so they came on in and they assisted us with the case. But at a certain point in time, it was clear to us that they did not share our viewpoint. And I'll tell you what happened. What happened was the city announced, we made an agreement, and then the city announced, said, well, if you drop the suit, we will, what happened here? I know what it was. They changed the ordinance. They passed a new ordinance. And they put in some language there. This was a little better than the old ordinance. And then these lawyers said, okay, now that we don't have to fight anymore because they changed the language of the ordinance. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to declare it a moot point. And that's a legal term, meaning the issue is moot. There is no more dispute. They've corrected all the deficiencies of the ordinance, the wording of the ordinance. But the intent of the new ordinance was the same. And so I told them, I said, if you can get the city of Salinas to publicly commit that they will not use any justification, because they wanted to say it's a public health and safety exception. They said, okay, we're going to give people their rights, but if there's a public health and safety exception, then they don't have any rights. We don't have to give them any warning. We don't have to store their property. We don't have to give them any due process. We just go in and take the tents down and take the property because it's a public health and safety hazard.
Which everything turns into.
What's that?
Then everything turns into a public safety hazard.
All right. So we said, no way. We're not going to agree to that. If the city says that, okay, then the other issue is resolved. But if the city doesn't make that commitment, they're just going to come in and break the whole camp up. I said, I want a commitment from the city of Salinas that they're not going to break the whole camp up. And the other lawyer said, no. They got a new ordinance, and that's a good thing, so let's just make this agreement, and let's move on to the next thing. So I went and talked to my clients, who were seven plaintiffs, and every one of them was a leader in the community. And they said, Anthony, how can we agree to this? They're going to be here tomorrow, and they're going to break the whole camp up. How can we agree to this? How can we drop our case? How can we say that the issue is moot just because they changed a few words around in the new ordinance? And so I could not get agreement from these other lawyers, so we got rid of them. And ultimately they did come in, and they broke up the whole encampment, but we were able to build the homeless union. So they didn't share our objective. Our objective was to build a movement, not just to be in court. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So winning doesn't always mean having a victory in court. Okay? And losing doesn't always mean that you've lost everything. All right? Because it's about, with each battle, have we increased our ability to influence things, to bring people into a movement, to change the conditions, to change the narrative, to change how the public perceives homeless people? That's what we're trying to do. Okay? And we use the court system to help do that. Yeah.
How long a stay did you have from them not breaking up the camp? I mean, did it give you time at least for the camp to still be there?
The amount of time that passed between when they announced when they were going to break up that camp and when they actually broke up the camp was just a 2 or 3 weeks. We went into federal court. We tried to convince the judge that he needed to issue an injunction. And that's a good point, because this is part of what I want to talk about. So I'm going to answer that. Let me use this example. So the first thing about an injunction is there's a lawsuit that's underlying it. But before you get to have a whole lawsuit run its course, you want the court to do something right away. Okay. The second thing, so what you need is you need to be able to convince the court that you are likely to prevail. Okay, that means you have to prove the court, we're going to win this. We'll probably win this case. Like with the example that we heard over here where they took your possessions. That sounds like it's a pretty clear case of a violation of the Fourth Amendment. They took your things. They had no legal justification for it. They didn't give you any chance to get it back.
They tend to move. They just show up and...
Right. Okay. We would probably win a lawsuit. Okay. But what we would want is an injunction to stop the police or stop the rangers from doing any more of that to anybody else. So we'd have to convince the court, give us the injunction, because we're going to probably win on the main lawsuit. It's more likely than not that we'll win. So you have to show that you're likely to prevail on the merits. Because the court is not going to issue an injunction if they don't think that you have a case. If they think you're never going to win that lawsuit, we're not going to issue any injunction. But if you can show them there's a good chance you're going to win the underlying lawsuit, then that's one of the things you need to show the court in order to get an injunction. Okay? So there's likely to prevail on the underlying lawsuit. The second thing you need to show is that the harm that's going to happen is irreparable. Irreparable harm means it can't be repaired. Okay?
And the loss of your rights, even for an instant, is irreparable.
Absolutely.
Right, that's a good point. So, that's exactly right. If they take away your right, for example, suppose I show up at City Hall and I'm protesting what the city wants to do, and I'm arrested before I can even get up and make my speech. I can never go back to that moment. I can never go back to that moment to exercise my rights at that moment, can I? And so it's irreparable. It can't be repaired. There's nothing they can do. Money won't compensate it. Nothing will restore that moment when they took away my right to speak out, my First Amendment right. So civil rights, the violation of civil rights are irreparable harms. Also irreparable would be, for example, if they take your identification, if they take your personal papers, if they take your personal effects. You guys know this. When they break up these camps and they do these sweeps, they take family portraits, photographs, keepsakes, jewelry. Yeah.
I have a question. So, and this might be jumping ahead, but if my injunction was do not close the Ross camp because it will cause irreparable harm for all those reasons that you said, you know, they would lose the safety and those type of things, what would my lawsuit then be on?
what would be the underlying lawsuit?
Right.
they're gonna break up the camp, right? So what's gonna happen to your personal possessions when they break up the camp?
You would lose them.
You would lose them. So the underlying lawsuit would be the Fourth Amendment violation. They seized your property. They've taken your property away from you, or they destroyed your property. Okay. Due process, meaning that under due process, you can't be deprived of your property without an opportunity to have to contest that action. For example, if they want to condemn my house, they can't just come in and knock it down. I have a right to make arguments as to why they shouldn't knock my house down. That's called due process. Okay? So those would be the underlying claims there. I think we have a 14th Amendment claim, due process. Fourth Amendment, we would argue also that you're denying people their First Amendment rights of association. We have made this argument that by breaking up these camps, they're destroying communities. And a community is an association of people. And it's a question of the right of association to be in a certain community. And by destroying the entire community, we start to cross over into a First Amendment right to have a freedom of association. They're also, for example, when they take your ID away from you, all kinds of rights have been taken away from you. Your right to vote. You may not be able to vote because you don't have your ID. You may not be able to get on an airplane. You may not be able to get on a train. You got to show your ID now to get on an Amtrak train. I don't know how many times this has happened to us, where we've had our members had their personal possessions and their ID taken from them, and all kinds of bad things happen as a result.
I have another question too. So would you have to wait because of this? So you're filing a lawsuit before this potentially happens to you?
You got it.
So you can file it and say that I don't want these things to happen to me simultaneously with the injunction instead of waiting until after they've already happened, right?
Yeah, what you do is you, generally speaking, and you guys can weigh in, generally speaking, you can go in for a motion for a preliminary injunction, okay? You want to stop them from doing this. But you have to argue that what they're doing is illegal. And that's your underlying lawsuit.
But they haven't done it yet.
But that's the whole point of a preliminary injunction.
Okay, got
it. You're showing that the harm is going to happen, and you don't have to wait for the actual harm to happen. Think what would happen if it was more likely than not some irreparable, irreversible harm was going to happen to you, and the court would say, well, just wait till it happens to you, and then come in and you can file your lawsuit. No. The reason that the remedy of an injunction is available is to stop the harm from happening before it happens. You don't have to wait.
File a lawsuit,
but it has to be irreparable harm.
It hasn't happened yet.
Because you're seeking a preliminary injunction. The harm, that's an imminent harm. You don't have to wait for it to happen before you have a cause of action.
Please don't just yell back and forth. Please, can we have people raise their hand so that we can get through this?
Shut up, you already talked longer than him.
Ed, did you want to help with this one?
What's the question?
So we're talking about the relationship between the motion for injunctive relief and the underlying lawsuit that would accompany such a motion. And so the question is, if the actual harm has not yet happened and you want to stop it from happening, we understand the injunctive relief part. What's the underlying lawsuit?
The underlying lawsuit is a suit for an injunction. I'm not sure I understand what
okay, so what you're saying is you could file a separate suit for an injunction before any harm has happened. You don't have to have a separate or accompanying lawsuit that makes a civil rights claim or any other kind of
thing. The threat is real.
Right.
You get a temporary restraining order.
Okay.
The same day you file.
Okay.
And the potential destruction of a community.
Okay. So what Ed is saying, and it's true, sometimes you can file simply for a preliminary injunction, temporary restraining order, and you don't have an underlying lawsuit. In most cases, though, an underlying lawsuit does exist.
I'm not saying that.
Yes.
You do have to have a lawsuit.
Right.
But as part of your approach.
Right.
Filed with the court.
So clarify.
Then you're lining up for a temporary restraining order.
Clarify what a preliminary injunction is.
I'm going to get there. Okay, so...
Hanson, did you want me to call people, or were you...
No, no, this is okay. Let's it's okay. We can take questions as they come up. Yeah.
I have a question. Okay. So right now you're talking about a preliminary injunction. And that's fine. But when you were starting the talk a few minutes ago, you said there's two kinds of injunctions, a mandatory injunction and a prohibitive injunction. Mm-hmm. Which one, or is this preliminary injunction a third type, or does it fall under one of those two?
No, preliminary injunction, it can be, is usually when you have a prohibitive injunction. In other words,
okay,
preliminary,
let me explain.
Okay.
Before it's decided.
Right, a preliminary injunction is something that is preliminary to what? It's preliminary to a full-blown hearing. You can go into court, we could go into court tomorrow, theoretically. We'll get into what elements, what evidence you'd have to have. But we could go into court tomorrow, theoretically, and file a motion for a temporary restraining order, which is, you know, that's what we're talking about. Preliminary, temporary restraining order, which means even before you have any trial, even before you call any witnesses, and in some cases, with no more than a phone call to the other side saying, I'm going to court tomorrow to seek a temporary restraining order against what you're about to do. So that's what, if you get the preliminary injunction, the court will issue, usually it's 10 days. They will order whatever's about to happen. They'll say, you can't do this. They preserve the status quo. You can't move forward. You cannot break up the camp, for example, on March 15th. You can't do that. Then in 10 days, there would be a hearing. And then the other side and the two sides argue as to whether the court should extend that injunction, should keep that injunction in place.
What do you have to show to the judge to get that preliminary injunction based on potential?
This is what we're talking about. You have to show that you're likely to win.
Okay, the same as the other injunction.
You have to show that the harm that's going to happen is irreparable harm. And
you
have to
post
the
bond.
What's that?
You have to post some money, too.
Bond?
No, you don't.
Are you sure?
You don't have to post money for a preliminary injunction. Some cases you do, but most you don't.
In case you lose,
you can plead poverty.
The other side has been damaged because they were preliminarily enjoined from doing what they could have done, so you have to pay for the damage there. So you usually
let them see.
In some cases, it usually happens. It usually happens when most lawsuits in this country are one business suing some other business. Right. Most of it is between businesses, and so when there's someone business. One business says, well, we don't want, say, General Motors doesn't want Chrysler to start selling their cars because they say Chrysler stole our patent for the radio or something like that, or they stole our design for the engine or something like that. But we don't want Chrysler to sell their cars because that's going to harm our business. Well, Chrysler says, yeah, but what if you're wrong about that and we can't sell our cars for 10 days? So they make them put up a bond. You know, they make them put up an amount of money just in case you're wrong and you shouldn't have got the preliminary injunction. Then you're going to make the side that you stopped, you're going to compensate them.
But you have to prove the likelihood of winning.
Pardon me?
To get that injunction, you have to prove likelihood of
succeeding. That's what I'm saying.
Anyway.
Yes. But I'm saying, the brother's bringing up the issue of a bond. Sometimes the court will make you pay a bond. Just in case your preliminary injunction, you lose, and you don't get it, once there's a hearing, he won't extend the injunction. The injunction should not have been issued in the first place. Now that the court's heard the evidence, he says, well, you shouldn't. I'm not going to extend my injunction. I'm not going to let this case go forward. And the money that you raise as a bond now is forfeited to whoever it was you tried to get the injunction against. But in all the lawsuits we've been involved, we've never had to post any kind of bond. Yeah, I don't know if that's been your experience.
You get a waiver, I'm sure.
Yeah, we never been. Yeah.
Sometimes in a car, if we do the steal, this thing, why the police tell the thief that they arrest you all the time? For example, I have a friend, he lost two of them, and I was the police officers, they are behind around with him.
You're saying that?
The police officers are around with the guy because he put a lost two against them, and keeping the head, and the police officers are arresting him all the time. He cannot be anywhere because the police go right there and make something up to put him in jail or something.
Well, I'm not going to stand up here and say that. That happens all the time.
Yeah,
the law is one thing. The reality of what happens out there on the streets and in the camps is another matter.
Yeah, but no. Something like that. And after that, No, police officer is supposed to harass him.
The police officer isn't the responsible.
I'm sorry?
In his, what happened to him, the police officer is the responsible party.
The police officer was not or was?
Isn't. You know why?
You tell me why.
He was working for the police.
The policeman was working for the police department.
That's right.
Well, police officers, individual police officers, under certain circumstances, can be held individually responsible for what they do.
Good luck.
That does happen.
Good luck.
Out of the, not in keeping with their job.
With the city's police department's rules and regulations, they have the big books of their protocols and things like that. Yeah.
I'm just saying that each case is different, but it is possible, and it does happen where an individual police officer is held individually liable for a violation of some kind.
Hard to do that.
Very hard to do that. Very hard to do that. I get that. That's true. But every once in a while, you're able to show that. It's extremely hard to do, especially nowadays when it seems like the police can get away with anything they want to get away with.
The Santa Cruz PD's manual says they're supposed to be polite to you at all times, but polite is relative, and you have their people deciding what polite means, and
right.
You don't get to decide what polite means.
Okay, so let me finish up with this. So you got to show that you're likely to win if there's an underlying lawsuit, your claim is constitutional rights are being violated, due process, they're taking your things, they're interfering with your right to travel. For example, we made argument, again, in Salinas, when they passed the ordinance, we made the argument that this ordinance, by making it impossible for a homeless person to put their property down on the street, you're essentially telling people outside the city of Salinas, don't come to Salinas. Don't come in here because we're going to take your stuff. Well, that's a restraint on travel. If you live in Modesto and you want to go to Salinas, but Salinas has an ordinance which lets the police or some city official take all your things, you're not going to want to go to Salinas, right? So we make the argument that sometimes what these cities do and the ordinances they pass are a restraint on travel. You have the right to travel. That's a right that you, the Supreme Court has upheld in Edwards versus California, the right for poor people to go from state to state. And within each state, you have the right to travel. So we've made that argument. So,
what arguments would you make here at this point?
Well, we're going to get to that. You guys are in a better position to make the arguments because you guys know the facts. But let me finish up and we'll start talking about what's the evidence to show that we have some kind of claim here or possibility of getting an injunction here. So the third thing you got to show in California, if you go to into state court, you have to show that there's something called the balance of hardships. Okay? All right. And what that means is let's take, for example, and this is probably what they're going to argue. If we were to go in and try to get an injunction to stop the destruction of the camp, of the Ross camp, before actual housing is provided, what's the counter argument? They say, well, that's a hardship to the city because there's a public health and safety issue. I just saw that there was a fire there the day before yesterday. They always use these things as an excuse to take down these camps.
Yep. Yeah. They let them occur.
First thing I said when I saw it,
yeah.
Rationalization.
Right, they do that all the time. They'll say that it's a blight.
Yep.
They'll say that the public interest in access to that land, the public can't get in there because of all these homeless people in their camp and their tents. There's drug use going on, there's crime going on, and so they would argue that the balance of hardships favors the city, not the homeless. We would argue that the balance of hardships is such that the homeless will suffer more hardship than the so-called public. I always point out, when the cities come up with this argument about public health and safety, that the homeless are part of the public.
The crime
how is it that the homeless all of a sudden are not part of the public? How is it that if you break up the camp and you exile 50, 100, 200 people out where they're isolated, where they're more at risk, where they're more likely to be hurt by others or hurt by weather conditions or run over by a train or whatever it is. How is that not a threat to public health and safety? So we need to make the argument when they start talking about public health and safety that the homeless are part of the public. And we've made this argument in all the cases we've brought. And they do carry some weight. And by making that argument, we're changing the narrative. Yeah. We're saying, don't think of the homeless as some species of people.
Exactly.
They're part of the public, and they deserve the same protection. So when you start talking about what's in the public interest, homeless lives are part of the public interest. The safety and security of homeless people is part of the public interest. Okay? So those are the three things you have to show if you are going to persuade the court to issue a preliminary injunction. Yeah?
Anthony, I just want to flag this, not that you have to go into it right now, but just heard that there was a drug-related overdose death like yesterday or today at the camp. At some point, could you talk about how the city might use that against us, that type of thing? Because I feel like it's in this ballpark that you're addressing right now, the health and safety that they could use against us. But I don't want to throw what you're doing off course either. I just kind of want to flag.
Well, let me address that in a couple of ways. The first thing is that there's drug use that happens every day in America, yes, all over America. Most of it happens behind closed doors.
No.
If there's drug use going on at 1731 South Sherbourne Drive, they're not going to evacuate and destroy and run everyone out of the entire 1700 block of Sherbourne Drive. If they have reasonable suspicion, probable cause, to go in and make an arrest for whatever it happens to be. Drug use standing alone is not necessarily even illegal. But what they do is they use these incidents as a justification to tear down the entire encampments, to take the position that these are... what's the word of crime? Nests of crime or infested. Crime. Now, one of the things that we're talking about, and Ed, you know, help me out here if I'm off track, is that over the last 10, 20 years, a number of cities have issued what's called gang injunctions, where they said that entire neighborhoods, they're going to issue an injunction against an entire neighborhood because those neighborhoods have a proliferation of gang members.
Do that in Salinas yet? I know they have a federalized gang intelligence.
Let me make my point. In Los Angeles was the first city to have a gang injunction. And it was in a neighborhood in San Fernando Valley where they just declared the entire neighborhood to be under an injunction, meaning that no more than two or three kids could assemble on the corner, no matter whether you're in a gang or not. No more than two or three on the corner, certain clothing, you have to be home by a certain time. I mean, they locked down the entire community by using the excuse of the criminal activity of the gangs.
Is that like martial law?
It was close. It was not quite martial law, but it was sort of like a completely controlled geographical area.
Curfew.
The courts have recently, there was a Supreme Court decision declaring unconstitutional these gang injunctions of saying you can't do that.
All right.
I don't think anyone has yet made the argument that a similar approach could be taken with homeless encampments. But what they're trying to do, when they find evidence of drug use or other kind of activity, to declare the entire community to be, that justifies enjoining, and in this case, destroying. This is even worse than the gang injunction. They essentially dismember. They essentially dismantle an entire community. Now, that's pushing the envelope, but I think that it's time to push the envelope. I think it's time to take in every possible credible legal argument that could be made. And I would recommend that if we do go forward, or if people go forward with this, that we take a careful and hard look at how the courts resolve the issue of these gang injunctions. Because they, for the most part, threw them all out as being unconstitutional. They said you cannot penalize an entire community. You cannot declare guilty by association simply because you live in this. You can't sanction this 15-year-old kid who's walking home because some other 15-year-old kid was involved in the gang. You just can't do it. Okay? Yeah.
And in 69, Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers in Chicago and Bunch Carter and the Black Panthers in L.A. were stopping the gang violence and getting the gangs to do community services like they were doing to probably protect their neighborhoods. So the FBI and the local police came in and spread false rumors and threats and lies and started up the gang violence. The FBI and the police want
COINTELPRO.
Now let me, that's right. Now let me tell you another reality and some of our experience with the union. We have in our union in Oakland, for example, we have people that are involved in something called the Green Team, the Project Green Team. And these are homeless leaders. They live in the homeless camps. But they started a program where they went around all the camps systematically and assisted them in keeping the camps relatively clean and well ordered. I know Wes, well, you guys know Wes. We had our own camp. The homeless union established a camp in front of City Hall that lasted for 6 months after they broke up the Chinatown homeless encampment. We had rules, and we called it the flagpole because it was right out of City Hall, right by the flagpole. We had rules in the flagpole camp. Those rules respected the privacy of what you did inside your tent, but the rules applied to what you did outside that tent. Because we did not want to give the City Police Department any pretext, any justification for coming in there. We didn't want to give Monterey County Code Enforcement any pretext, any justification for coming in there. And this is happening a lot now. In the camp, people begin to realize, let's do something here so they cannot use that excuse. In Salinas, what was happening, for example, is that people would come in the dead of night and just dump furniture and garbage on Soledad Street. Then they blame the homeless, right? But these things were coming in from the outside. It was a dumping ground, literally. And the police weren't doing anything about it. We set up, you know, this doesn't need to be recorded. We set up a team to monitor that conduct. We got the license plates and descriptions of these vehicles. And we also started publicizing what's going on here, of who's really creating this thing. And then we had our own team, that's mainly this group called the Hemp Group, homeless, God dang it, I can't remember the acronym, but it was Diana Blaylock and Rita Costa and some of the other women that were involved in our lawsuits. And they have a team that went around and kept that place clean. And don't mess with them women if you violate that rule. But now, on the one hand, we don't want to be a police force and we don't want to... In the river, in Marysville, the city of Marysville came all the time down to the encampments. They made promises that they were going to build some kind of washing stations there. They brought prisoners who had been released from the California Department of Corrections. They would bring them to the camp, because they knew that this was a good thing for them. They'd be rehabilitated in the camps. We had a circulating library in one of the camps with 3,500 books that they destroyed when they broke up the camp. Oh, we had college students coming to the camp to learn what the reality was of homelessness. So who were the homeless and how were people taking care of each other up in these camps. And the city recognized some of the value of the services that were being provided there. You had police would take homeless people off the streets of Marysville and take them down to the camp. I don't know if that's happened here in Santa Cruz, but when the city takes affirmative steps to relocate people from one part of town into a homeless camp, we have been able to argue that the city has created a duty as a landlord or a custodian over a certain body of land. And we've actually survived a motion to dismiss on this theory recently in our case in Marysville.
Great.
Yeah. So these are somewhat novel legal arguments. Some of them have been used in other lawsuits, some of them have not. But I will tell you that if you study history, you can't just go with the status quo. You have to start changing the dynamic. You have to start getting people to think about things in a different way. Okay? So anyway, I'm kind of getting off the point, but I think that the issue of the city using an excuse to take something down, that there's a lot of different ways we can approach this. But one of the ways you want to do this is you want to exercise or make an effort to try to convince people that it's in their interest to try to have some measure of discipline in the camp as best they can. Now, it's not my... If I live in a green tent and next to me is a guy in a blue tent, it's not my responsibility to manage the behavior of the guy in the blue tent. Any more than if I live next door, I live at 1714 Main Street and 1716 Main Street, I'm not responsible for what the guy does next door. They shouldn't be tearing my house down simply because there's criminal activity next door. But that's exactly what they do in the camps. So I think we need to start making arguments that these camps are actual communities. There are already decisions, and Ed, help me out here too, that you have a Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy, a First Amendment expectation of privacy in your tent. You have an expectation of privacy in your tent. Now, that didn't used to be the case. Police could come right up and just rip the tent open and say, get out of here, or they'd come into the tent. This would happen all the time. There was no conception that the tent was actually a location that was deserving of First Amendment protection or Fourth Amendment protection. Increasingly, the courts are now saying, yes, they are. You can't go, cops cannot go into that tent without a warrant or without some exigent circumstance. That is, if they see a crime being committed or they have probable cause to believe that a crime will be committed. Absent that, you have a privacy interest in that tent. So if you have a privacy interest in the tent, then what about the generalized interest of the community of tents, of tent dwellers? See what I'm trying to say? So we need to change the narrative a little bit as we go forward, and we need to redefine how the public is perceiving these homeless encampments. But it's going to take some work, and it's going to take some organization. And is this stuff resonating at all with you guys?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I'm gonna try to finish up, and we kind of open it up here.
I spoke with Desiree a little bit about that, and Crystal is helping with more of the garbage cleanup so that it maintains like cleanliness. They're also going around and trying to get more people like names to be on the council so that they have more of a group.
So they have a council?
Right.
They have an organizing council at Ross Camp?
They do, but there's only 5 people on it right now.
Okay.
And Desiree told me basically like with the garbage and stuff, she's doing the best she can. And there's certain elements that are kind of like out of her control, like the things that happened yesterday. Because I called her when the fire was happening and I said, what happened? And she said, you know, it's cold out here and we have to cook. Certain things are kind of out of our control.
I was thinking of a resolution that you need a dining plot. You shouldn't be cooking in a tent like that. That's always been camping no-no. You cook outside.
I'm not advocating for cooking in the tent.
Well, the point is, something should be arranged so people can shelter while they're cooking in, like, a dining fly or something like that, you know.
I'll tell you that the more self-organization that can happen in these camps, the better it's going to be. The more we can represent that these camps are camps of last resort. The housing has not been made available. The cities have not even disclosed. We met with the city manager. This is not for the tape either. We met with the city manager of Seaside the other day, and we asked him if he could identify for us all of the properties that were owned or controlled by the city of Seaside, all the delinquent properties that ostensibly could be, that the city could simply take over and make available to the homeless. He gave me a list of the homeless students in the 3 towns that comprise that area of the Monterey, that part of the Monterey County Unified School District. 900 students.
Wow.
900 students. I'm going to tell you what this guy came up with. This guy's not a bad guy. He said, well, instead of taking, the kids are all riding buses. They're in shelters. Some of them are on the streets. Some of them are in foster care. Some of them are doubling, tripling up in apartments. You know, the circumstances of homeless students are all over the map. But there's something between 10 and 25% of all students in the United States now are homeless, including at some of the most prestigious universities. They have a homeless student union at Berkeley. They have a homeless student union at Columbia University in New York. Okay? So we met with this guy, and his idea is rather than having all these kids bust in every day into the school and then bust back out to where they're living, a camp, a shelter, you know,
school,
whatever it happens to be, put the housing in the school. Just like they do at colleges, dormitories, on-campus housing. And it's brilliant, and we're going to support him with that. This
what
is the guy.
I don't
Seaside.
Know about
Seaside.
That.
You don't know about that.
It sounds a lot like Carlisle Indian Industrial School to me, but. Yeah.
Illegally downloading music from the internet, we're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.5 FM. Through every station in the house.
You fucked it up. Okay, let's try that again.
No way, that's the one.
Dear listeners, all of us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz announce with great sadness that our dear and beloved Uncle Dennis has passed away, surrounded by the love of his family. You may remember him for his truly great show, From the Cream to the Dregs, or for the so much needed echo news about the state of our planet, like Earth First Update. Uncle Dennis was one of the founders of Free Radio Santa Cruz. He dedicated much of his life to its survival, keeping the ship going despite all the difficulties, from the recovery after the 2004 raid and the consequent confiscation of gear, to the frequent site change for transmitter and antenna. We largely owe to Uncle Dennis the nearly uninterrupted broadcast for these couple decades. We all will remember him as a true guide for our collective and a wonderful, generous companion of many adventures. He made many years of Free Radio Santa Cruz possible, and we are so grateful for his dedication and so saddened by his passing. Rest in peace, dear Uncle Dennis, great show host, friend, leader, one amazing...